Hey everyone, welcome to the 975th show, and guess what? I have an announcement for you. After 19 years of weekly shows, I have decided to hang up my spurs and ride off into the sunset of retirement. You know, it's been an amazing part of my life as I have met so many interesting people, some of whom have become clients and others who have written in or attended my talks throughout the years, and those who have remained loyal listeners, not even to mention the great guests that I've interviewed, so smart and informative and helpful to all of us. I would especially like to thank all of you in the Sunday Morning Breakfast Club, as I call it. You know, those of you who rise early and put my show on as the first or second show in their morning routine. It's an honor that you have thought enough of the work we did to include me in the Sundays of your life. Today's program will be the first of the final three, with our last airing on May 24th. In the meantime, I'll be keeping you up to date on the investment world during this crazy time, as well as replaying some of our favorite shows over the years. I'll also be keeping the website active with all the past episodes, so if you want to hear something again or get in touch, you can contact me there. Of course, that's stevepomerantz.com. Before I get to today's commentary, though, I would like to tell you a quick story of how we got started and the one person who was most helpful at the very beginning. His name was Daryl Lagulo. For those of you who have been with me from the beginning, you may remember that Daryl and I co-hosted the show in the first few years. Daryl was helping me with my fledgling investment practice, and he was the one with the radio experience. As a matter of fact, when he approached me with the idea of doing a radio show, I told him that the only network I would do it on was NPR. Incredibly, he simply suggested we contact the local station, WXEL, and ask them. Honestly, it was not something I thought was even possible, and sure enough, they said no at first. So we told them we were going to be doing something different, and could we make a demo to show them what we had in mind? You see, the fact that I was a fee-only advisor who didn't sell any products and wanted to educate and protect listeners was a pretty rare thing 19 years ago. Well, the rest is history, and the station took a chance on me. So thank you, Daryl Lagulo, who sadly passed away very young just a few years ago. I am forever indebted to him for guiding me into this wonderful path. Okay, let's talk about what's going on right now. So here's a question. Where's Warren Buffett? If you remember the 2008 crisis, he was all over the airwaves telling us to buy America and even doing a lot of buying himself. His billion-dollar deals with Goldman Sachs and General Electric for 12% interest, plus options to buy more stock at very reasonable prices, became the stuff of Wall Street legend. You know, hey, $5 billion could get you a lot back then, right? Heck, he even bought Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway for $26 billion. Now that was a bet on America. Today, however, he's pretty silent. So I did some digging, and this is what I found. First, it seems we can only see the selling part of his activity. He sold his investment in a slew of airlines from United to American to Southwest Air, stating that the industry had changed so dramatically that he couldn't tell what the future would look like. It had changed that much. So, despite of the fact that his original investment was $4 billion, he sold all the shares he owned. Other than that, we know that he sold a small amount of Bank of New York Mellon shares, too, for only about $31 million. Some who follow Buffett have made some guesses, though, so let's see what they have to say. A few of them have looked into his fourth quarter buying, that's fourth quarter of 2019, and then extrapolated from there. So number one, it seems pretty clear that Buffett likes bank stocks. He likes J.P. Morgan and U.S. Bank Corp. Both stocks, though, got slaughtered during the sell-off, so maybe he picked up some more of those two. It's also a good bet that he purchased shares of Berkshire Hathaway, you know, his company. He's been talking a lot about this for a very long time, and there's nothing stopping him as far as I can see. He's not taking any money from the government, and considering that Berkshire had something like $128 billion in cash on hand recently, That means he's got an awful lot of money to buy back his own shares. Unfortunately, we won't know exactly what he's done until mid-May when he files the 13F with the SEC and discloses his activity. Other stocks he may have picked up could be Kroger's, General Motors, and Biogen. These are three he's been interested in. He seems to like Occidental Petroleum recently, but with the latest insane sell-off in oil, he may take a wait-and-see attitude. Finally, his partner Charlie Munger has given us a little insight to the way things are being viewed over there. In a recent Wall Street Journal interview, Munger was quoted as saying Buffett has been fairly conservative, and that's a quote, with his investments in the current market. Nobody in America's even seen anything like this, he said. This thing is different. Everybody talks as if they know what's going to happen, and nobody knows what's going to happen. So, he continued, companies are not calling Berkshire for capital like they were in 2008. The phone is not ringing off the hook, says Munger, because many companies are all negotiating with the government for bailout money, so they're not calling Warren. Now, Warren Buffett isn't the only one with a lot of cash to spend. Companies like Blackstone, Carlyle, and KKR have $1 trillion in cash to swoop in to troubled companies, and they've wasted no time making purchases in industries like travel, entertainment, and energy. It's not that easy for the whole private equity industry, though they already have billions invested in many of these troubled areas, and they're suffering a lot of losses at the moment. So much so, they're begging the government for monetary relief, if you can believe that. For those PE firms with money, investments have already been made in Expedia for over $5 billion from Apollo Global and Silver Lake. Apollo Global also invested $300 million in Cimpress, C-I-M-P-R-E-S-S. That's the commercial printing company that owns Vistaprint. You may have heard of Vistaprint. Silver Lake, who I mentioned before, and Sixth Street Partners have also invested in Airbnb, which just raised $1 billion in a new round of funding. And so, the cycle of capitalism does its work, transferring ownership from weak hands to strong hands. Weak hands that perhaps used too much debt to finance expansion, or whose business model wasn't able to withstand a shock of this magnitude. Strong hands are those that saved excess capital and didn't get caught up in the excitement of a market that seemed to go up forever. You know, this is one of a number of cycles I've seen since I entered the business in 1981, and it was going on well before me, and it will continue to go on well after I'm gone. Speaking of gone, I am moving on to other things. My plans for the future are manyfold. First, you might not know this, but I am also a musician with my own band, the Steve Pomerantz Band, which you can follow on Facebook and Instagram and at our website, stevepomerantzband.com. Also, I plan to travel for long periods once it's safe. Italy is our number one choice. I also have a son and daughter who are in the arts as well, so I'll be working with them. And my daughter, for one, is a wonderful singer and talented songwriter, so I'm ending today's show with a little slice of her music. She calls herself Walter and can be found on Spotify and all the other important music platforms. That's W-A-L-T-Z-E-R. And of course, she has a website and so on. Please remember that our last show will be on Sunday, May 24th, and we will keep the website active if you would like to stay in contact after that. So farewell until next week. Here's a bit of her music. Please enjoy. Found my bags easy, only sore eyes could see. Beat up, sacky, dirty clothes I found for cheap. Taped up and used up and rolled down that chain. Stuck between a duffel bag and leather briefcase. I wonder where these travelers go when their hands on the way to their destinations. Do they travel more through time than space? Do lots of traveling just stay in one place? This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. With many industries in the U.S. ground to a halt because of social distancing restrictions, the personal finance website WalletHub today released its report on the states slowing down the most during the COVID-19 pandemic. And I also want to talk about the states with the biggest increases in unemployment. Joining me is Jill Gonzalez, spokesperson and financial analyst for WalletHub.com. Welcome to the program, Jill.
Thanks for having me.
You know, the pandemic has definitely replaced the hustle and bustle of everyday life. We're discouraged or even legally prevented from going out except to essential errands or work. Some industries have suffered more than others, obviously, but let's first talk about the states. And you did a survey or created some research which showed which states are shut down the most or slowing down the most. Can you go through that with us, please?
Yeah, to really see which states are slowing down the most because of the pandemic, we looked at six different metrics, and they're essentially the increase or decrease, mostly decrease, in visits to various types of places due to the virus. So categories are like retail and recreation, kind of drops in visits to those types of places, or grocery stores, parks, transit stations, workplaces. So we're really seeing where people are staying home the most, essentially, and where things have just really come to a halt.
You know, some states are incredibly buttoned up. Like I'm looking at the state that has slowed down the most during the pandemic, and that is Hawaii, with a total score of almost 92. Tell us about the methodology and how you get to a score of 92, and what do you think that score really means?
So it's all added up to a 100-point scale between those six metrics that I said. So everything is weighted equally. And essentially, the bigger the decrease in the mobility, the bigger the score. So Hawaii essentially has seen huge decreases in how many people are going to retail and recreation places, even grocery stores, which have probably seen the smallest decrease throughout this.
Yeah.
In Hawaii, we're seeing a decrease of around 60%. People are going to the grocery store 60% less. And in Hawaii, it's, you know, a few different things. One, it's such a state reliant on travel and tourism. So a lot of people are not able to work right now because that's not really happening. And it has to really keep people indoors in their homes because it's an island. You know, they don't have the resources to deal with a health epidemic and pandemic of this size.
Right. So it's like some of these small countries around the world that have been able to shut down completely because they have a homogeneous population or whatever reason the government got more influence than other countries, and Hawaii represents one of those. The other state we hear about the most is New York. New York is number two on the list, and that has a score of 77. So there's a large discrepancy between Hawaii and New York, even though New York is number two.
That's right. So in New York, people are still going to places like grocery stores a little bit more than they are, say, in Hawaii. But everything else, you know, is pretty much a no-go. New York has seen the highest retail and recreation decrease in mobility. Same with the highest transit stations. Not a lot of people relying on public transportation, which is really hard to fathom in New York in general. And the same with workplace. And I think that's something that we're going to see remain in New York more so than other states. You know, if people do not have to report to a physical work location, they're not going to now and probably for quite a while in the future.
Yeah, that's going to be a very interesting outcome of all of this, is how work habits are going to change, how many of our habits are going to change. Now, most of my listeners are in Florida, so we're all really interested to know where we rank in this measurement of relative slowdowns. Where does Florida rank?
Florida ranks the sixth overall. So things have slowed down a lot there. I think the elderly population is certainly one reason, you know, people trying to keep them safe, the elderly themselves trying to keep themselves safe, not really venturing out as much. And Florida is an interesting case. You know, we see reports on the news of very crowded beaches, while at the same time, a lot of elderly communities that are really locking down.
Yeah. Well, you know, you see those reports about the beaches, but I can tell you from the area that I live, all the beaches are closed, all the parks are closed. And I noticed in some of the other research that that is really not the case in many, many states. The parks are open. Golf is still something that's made available under certain restrictions. But in the areas that I live in South Florida, everything is pretty much shut down. I think some of the reports showing the open beaches is really the exception rather than the rule, though I could be wrong. Now, I have relatives in Illinois, in Colorado, in Massachusetts, and in California, and just out of potluck here, you know, we see that Illinois is ranked 22% with a score of 43, which is pretty darn low, I would think. Well, let's go for giggles. Let's take a look at the very last state, which is Nebraska, right?
Yeah, Nebraska is 50th here. Ahead of that, Kansas, Arkansas, Kentucky, Iowa, Alabama, Ohio. So a lot of Midwestern and a lot of Southern states with the least amount of slowdown. And like you said, a lot of those places have not closed parks necessarily. So people have been going out there. Some of those places, as of now, are reopened or at least partially reopened.
Yeah, we hear about that.
So, you know, a tale of two very different Americas.
That is America for you. Let's take a look at the different industries. So the highest retail and recreation, New York has the highest decrease in mobility. It's kind of a funny way to say that. Followed by New Jersey, Michigan, Hawaii, and Montana. The lowest, as you just mentioned, Kentucky, Nebraska, Oklahoma, West Virginia. Highest grocery and pharmacy mobility changes. Well, you mentioned Hawaii. Florida is number three here. Vermont is number two. The lowest is Tennessee, Alabama, Kentucky. Highest parks, decrease in mobility, Hawaii and Florida, as I just mentioned. Texas, Montana, California comes after that. The lowest is Wisconsin, Indiana, Connecticut, and Ohio. And, you know, you also did a study at how it breaks down to red and blue states. So that's really interesting. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there's quite a large difference here. Red states are slowing down considerably less than blue states during the pandemic. Their average rank here was about 32, whereas blue states were about 16. So essentially double the difference here.
Can you think of any reason for that in particular?
I think just in terms of states reopening, you know, you're either prioritizing the economy or you're prioritizing health.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the blue states are prioritizing health right now, and a lot of the red states are prioritizing an economy.
Yeah.
I think you could also argue that the blue states were hit sooner. You know, New York, the epicenter,
right,
blue state, hit much sooner. They essentially are witnessing or just witnessed the peak. So they are, you know, on the downhill now, whereas some of these states, especially down south, haven't had their peak yet. So, you know, they might think that this problem is just on a smaller scale for them when really they just haven't seen the scale yet.
Mm-hmm. I also think there were some messages from the national government early on, you know, about the virus not taking it too seriously. So that may be carrying over to some degree. Let's talk about the U.S. economy and look at those states that have had the biggest increases in unemployment. Florida, at least the week that this survey was done, Florida was the most effective in the country. Can you take us through some of those on the list?
Yeah, absolutely. When it comes to unemployment in general, we've seen, this is something that we update week to week, and we've seen it remain pretty consistent as far as the states that are pretty much hit repeatedly every week. I think that we might see that change soon as the different job industries are affected. But Florida, because it relies so much on the travel industry, on tourism industry, that's, you know, one of the states that's been hit repeatedly hard by this. They've seen about a 6,000% increase,
wow,
in unemployment claims just when you're looking at this time now versus last year.
Interestingly, Louisiana is next, and both the week affected in a particular week and since the COVID-19 crisis began. Why Louisiana? Is it travel as well?
Oh, yeah. Huge travel place. Just going to New Orleans, did live music festivals, jazz fest, mm-hmm. to all of these things that are canceled. Big spring break place as well. So all of those plans canceled. And Louisiana kind of has it twofold because the other industry that's huge there is oil. Oh. And that's, you know, taken a huge hit as well.
Right. Colorado was number 10 for the most affected during that week, 14 since the beginning of the crisis. We have California most affected, 36. California has maintained lower numbers. Any expectations as to why that might be?
I think when we think of California, we might think Hollywood, which is very affected here. The entertainment industry in general, largely shut down.
Yeah.
Tourism, again, pretty big there, largely shut down. But what California has is the Silicon Valley, and tech is booming mm-hmm.
yeah.
right now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really its saving grace.
Okay, interesting. And another thing that interests me too is Massachusetts. So it's all in that northeastern corridor. You think New York being a population center, and you think Massachusetts or Boston being pretty much a population center. But yet Massachusetts, its effect unemployment-wise since the start of the crisis is 35th in the nation. Does that seem to be unusual to you?
Massachusetts is also a large technology hub.
Okay.
You have Harvard and MIT right there by Boston. Mm-hmm. A lot of tech companies are based out of Boston. And the other thing that Massachusetts is very well known for is healthcare, which is, again, for horrible reasons, booming right now.
Interesting. Now, the blue states versus the red states with unemployment claims, how does that shake out?
Right now, blue states have a lower increase in unemployment claims, again, because of the job families. When we talk about technology, the Northeast is very heavy there. The West Coast, very heavy there. So Washington, Oregon, California, not really seeing the amount of layoffs and furloughs that we're seeing in a lot of red states. So the average rank here, where closer to the bottom is better, was around 32 for blue states, 22 for red states.
My guest, Jill Gonzalez, is a spokesperson and financial analyst for WalletHub.com. For more information about this and a lot of other good articles about money and other things, go to WalletHub.com. Jill, thank you for joining me today.
Anytime. Thank you.
Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes made of ticky-tacky. Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky.
You're listening to the Steve Pomerantz Show. I'm here with Terry Story, a 31-year veteran with Keller Williams, and we're going to talk about buying and selling real estate in the new norm, the new pandemic norm. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
I especially want to take us through the process of closing on a home so we can kind of get an image in our minds of what it's going to look like. So what is the first thing that happens?
Sure. Well, assuming that the property is already listed and we're talking about the buyer side of things. So at this point, I would have already made videos of the home, virtual tours, professional photography. We have the buyer view all of those items first. And if they like the home enough and want to proceed to the next level, then we will bring them to the house wearing protective gear, masks, gloves, booties if required. And the way it works, Steve, is we're not allowed to be on premise with them. So we would open up the door and let them in. And we stay off, off-site. We're not allowed to be with them, nor can the seller be with them, nor their other agent.
All right, so you have strangers going into someone's house. How are you pre-qualifying these people?
Sure. So before we let a stranger in somebody's house, first of all, we're assuming at this point the other agent knows them, has copies of their driver's license, and that they are qualified. The most important part in all of this is we want, if they're paying cash, that we have proof of funds, that they actually have the money in the bank as of today, and that if they're getting finance, that they are truly already approved for their finance. In other words, they're not a pre-qual approval, but something that's more in depth. Mm-hmm. You got to remember, we're bringing strangers into people's homes and we're exposing them to people going into their house. Yeah. And we want to minimize that as much as possible. So quite frankly, the only people really out looking at property are your serious, most motivated buyers, because why would you be doing this right now unless you needed a house?
Yeah. Well, the other aspect of this is that qualifying these days is a little tougher.
That's right.
The banks are looking more deeply, not only into the assets that you have saved or the down payment, but they're looking at your job and the ability for your job to stay in place.
That's right. And so we're going to ask more candid questions to make sure that, you know, we feel that your job isn't in jeopardy.
Mm-hmm.
And we do the best that we can. We can only qualify as far and deep as we can. But so far, everything, knock on wood, has been going through for us.
Now, would you say that if you're selling your home and the buying agent or the buyers come to your property and they haven't been pre-qualified, or the agent's not doing this kind of work, should you look a little bit askance at that?
Yes, I think so. As the listing agent, my obligation is to, well, we work as transaction brokers to make sure that we're being fair to everyone and that we're only bringing ready, willing, and able buyers through a seller's property, especially right now.
Right now. So after all of that has happened and an offer is made, a price is agreed upon, what are the next steps?
So the next steps, once it's agreed upon and we know that they're qualified, it's business as usual. They go on to their inspection period. We're doing them in a shorter period of time. We don't need 10 days. We're doing them in 7 days because the inspectors aren't that busy. You can get somebody out there the next day. So we don't need 10 days, 15 days for an inspection period. So we're doing those quicker.
Well, that's good news.
Yep. The lending process is still the same, except we're monitoring it every few days. We're calling the lender to make sure that everything's being done still in a timely fashion. The buyer's cooperating, getting everything over to them as needed, and just staying on top of it. And then, quite frankly, we're communicating more so than we ever have with the other realtor to make sure that their buyer's still in on it, that they're still motivated, that everybody is working towards the same goal of getting to the closing table.
Well, generally, you know what obstacles mortgage-wise are coming your way. So you're trying to get those questions answered quickly and upfront more than ever before.
That's correct.
Okay. Also, every mortgage broker and bank in town now knows your name. Is that it?
And pretty much. By now, they should. So we're going through that aggressively. And it makes a difference who you use for finance. I just had multiple offers and we went with the person that was most qualified, who is already approved for their finance. And, oh, by the way, I happen to know who that mortgage broker was. And so when I called him on a Sunday night, A, he answered the phone, and B, already had the right answers that I was looking for.
Perfect.
So if you're a buyer, make sure you're dealing with a very reputable mortgage lender.
Okay. Now, what about the closing itself? I don't think that there's a table that everyone's going to sit at. So how has that changed?
Right. So it can be done remotely. Certain lenders have the approval to do closings remotely. The issue is, you know, you need documents notarized, but there are ways of doing that. And they have relationships with certain lenders. So that's a new trend for us here. So we're starting to do that. The title companies, if need be, will go out to the buyer to have documents signed. Agents are becoming couriers.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it takes to get the documents signed. What we're not seeing, though, is a coming together all together at a title company, buyers and sellers and realtors all sitting around as documents are signed.
Those days are over for a while.
Those days are over, probably forever.
But the title industry really hasn't moved totally towards digital either.
They're working towards it. There's a lot of legalities that they're going through. Mm-hmm. I know that one title company we work with has a relationship with a certain number of lenders, and they are now able to go totally digital. Some lenders are sending the documents in advance to the buyers to sign, a large portion of the documents, so that at the closing table, there are less documents to actually sign. So that's a nice thing, too.
Okay, so once the deal is closed, and how does someone pick up the keys? What's the process there? Something so simple, but yet you wonder.
Sure. So typically, the seller signs the documents first, then the buyer signs the documents, and the buyer does not get the keys until the funds have been wired and, you know, cleared, which is all usually done the same day. So the keys, the way that I personally handle it is all the keys are left in the house with the clickers, except one key. One key I hold back, and as soon as the transaction is totally closed and funded, we will make arrangements to get that key to the buyer.
My guest, as always, is Terry Story, a 31-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Listening to the Steve Pomerantz Show. Throughout the years, I've replayed a few segments now and again. These turned out to be my favorites because the subject was relaxed and honest about their view of their accomplishments. They also spoke candidly of some of the decisions they made to bring them the success they sought. This is one of those segments. Please enjoy my interview with Wayne Huizinga. My guest is a person that needs little introduction. He's the only person in history to build three Fortune 1000 companies practically from scratch: Waste Management, Blockbuster Entertainment, and AutoNation. He's the only person to have developed six New York Stock Exchange listed companies. He also owns the Miami Dolphins and is the previous owner of the Florida Marlins baseball team and the Panthers hockey team, making him the only person ever to own three pro teams in a single market, two of which won national championships. In 1992, he received the Horatio Alger Award, given to honor Americans who have overcome adversity to achieve great success. He's also a five-time recipient of Financial World Magazine's CEO of the Year, and he was named Ernst & Young's 2004 U.S. Entrepreneur of the Year and 2005 World Entrepreneur of the Year. The list goes on, but instead, let's meet the man who has achieved all of this and get some insight into his world. Wayne Huizinga, welcome to On the Money.
Thanks, Steve. Happy to be here.
Wayne, let's start at the beginning. How did you end up in the waste business?
Oh, man, you talk about being in the right place at the right time. That's the way it was for me. When I got out of the Army, my father took me to lunch the next day, and at lunch, bumped into an old high school friend of his who turned out to be in the waste collection business in Chicago. He was down here because he had three trucks operating up in Pompano Beach, Florida. And over lunch, he said he was looking for a new manager. And he asked me what I was doing, and I said, well, I just got out of the Army yesterday, and I don't have a job yet. He said, good, you're my new manager. Well, that is not what I wanted to hear, you know. But he said, okay, fine, I understand you don't want to be in a waste business, but do me a favor and take this job for 3 weeks to help me out until I can bring someone from Chicago down here to run the business. Well, 3 weeks turned into 3 months and 4 months and so forth. So finally one day I flew to Chicago and I said, Herman, I want to buy your business.
I don't understand that. How did you start from the very beginning and get to the point where you could turn around and buy his business?
Well, I didn't like the business to begin with, but after I was there for 3 or 4 months, I thought, you know, this isn't such a bad idea. And at the same time, there was a small business for sale in Fort Lauderdale. Mm-hmm. And it was, when I say small, it was really small. It was $500 a month worth of business. So I thought about buying that business, and I thought about Herman's business. And so I flew to Chicago, and I said, Herman, I want to buy your business. He said, great. This was a long time ago. Now mm-hmm. This is in 1962. He said, I want $35,000 for my business, and I don't own any of the trucks. I lease the trucks. Uh-huh. And I said, okay, fine, I'll buy it from you. He said, how are you going to pay me? I said, you're going to finance me. And he looked at me, and he said, okay, I'll take a chance on you. He said, but understand one thing. I'm not doing this for you. I'm doing this because I'm a friend of your father's. Uh-huh. And I said, great. And so I bought that business and then bought the little business in Fort Lauderdale. So now we had three trucks running in Pompano Beach and one in Fort Lauderdale. And back in those days, they were separate cities. They weren't connected like they are today. And so I got in business kind of by accident, something I really didn't want to have. And that's kind of been a story for me, Steve. I've been lucky in being in the right place at the right time. And sometimes I even said I didn't want to be in that business and ended up going in it anyway and turned out to be the right thing to do.
So, Wayne, how did you manage to build this company, Waste Management, as it turned out to be, into this giant public company that it became?
Well, Well, I ran the company here in South Florida for about 10 years. And by that time, we had expanded down into Miami and Hollywood, and we picked up the refuse for the city of Key West, and had a small business in Tampa, and then a fellow that was married to my cousin ran a family-owned business, a business that was owned by my three uncles. My three uncles all died under the age of 50, and so he was running the business in Chicago, and I heard of his name because he was married to my cousin, but I never met him. So he came down to Florida and on vacation, and we chatted and talked, got to be good friends. And a year or so later, he came back to Florida, and he said, you know, hey, I've been thinking. He said, you know, you're really in a fast-growing market, and how are you growing this business so fast? Where are you getting the money? I said, man, I own every bank in Florida money. Are you kidding? And he said, well, we're doing really well up there, but we're not growing so fast because it's more of a stable market. So to make a long story short, he suggested, not me, but he suggested that we go into the we merged the two companies together, and mine was called Southern Sanitation, and his was called ACE. So we merged the companies together and called them Waste Management.
Oh.
And 6 months later, took it public,
mm-hmm.
and then we had a high multiple on our stock, and so we went out. Our plan was to grow nationwide. But rather than start from scratch with one or two trucks in each market, we thought we'd buy the best guy out in each market we wanted to be in. Most of that was in the Sun Belt. And so we went around the country trying to find the best operator in each market. And we acquired that person and let the person stay on and manage the business for us. And grew the business internally very aggressively after that. After we once made the acquisition, we wanted internal growth rather than acquisition growth. And so we acquired 100 companies in 9 months around the United States.
So, Wayne, you had this high multiple. In other words, the public stock was selling at a high price to its earnings, and you were able to use that as a kind of currency?
Yeah, we were about 30 times earnings, and we were buying people out at 10 times earnings. Mm-hmm. And so we had a spread. And, you know, that only helped the stock go up more.
Sure.
The more companies we bought, the higher the stock went up.
Because Wall Street's looking for growth, right?
That's exactly right. And so it wasn't long before we gave them all the growth they wanted without doing so many acquisitions because we were in the great markets and we were growing internally.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So eventually, I guess you got that business to a certain size and you decided to change direction?
Well, we grew all around the United States, and then we went international. And we had businesses in Australia and Argentina and Venezuela and all throughout Europe. We were in Hong Kong and we were in Saudi Arabia. It grew to be a very big company in a short period of time. And I was commuting from Florida for 10 years. I commuted to Florida every Sunday night, came home on Saturday, Friday night or Saturday. And I got tired of doing that and said, well, I'm going to retire for a while. And so we did not sell the company, and I did not sell my stock. And decided I was going to take a year off and kind of goof around for a while. Well, that lasted 3 weeks, and I was climbing the walls, and so start going in other businesses.
I'm speaking with Wayne Huizenga, probably one, if not the most, one of the most successful entrepreneurs in the country, perhaps the world. We've just discussed how he developed the business Waste Management. Wayne, let me ask you this question about Blockbuster. You know, some have called you a visionary for starting Blockbuster, but you see it a little differently. How did that business begin for you?
Well, a good friend of mine by the name of John Melk lived in Chicago, and he used to work for Waste Management. He retired a year after I did, and he called me one day. It was in November of 1986, and he said, Wayne, I've got a great business. I've invested in as a limited partner in a video store. And the guy that owns this business, he said, he's going to grow rapidly, and you should see this video business, Wayne. It's really great. And I thought to myself, there's no way. I mean, I didn't even own a VCR at that time, much less have never been in a video store or rented a video. And this fellow would call me, once or twice a month. And finally, in late January, I was in Chicago doing some business, and he called my office, and my assistant said, no, he isn't here. He's in Chicago. He said Chicago. So he tried to run me down in Chicago, and he couldn't find me. So he went to the airport and waited for me to come back to get on the airplane. And when I got there, he said, no, you're not going home till you see my video store. So reluctantly, I went with him to see the video store. After that, I was very, very impressed with his Blockbuster store. Mm-hmm. But that's not the way, you know, the newspaper writes it or the magazines write it. They talk about what a great visionary Wayne is, and he came up with this concept and this idea, and that really wasn't the way it happened.
You were no technology guru who saw the future.
No, I was just my good friend saw an opportunity. You know, I thought that renting videos was dark, dirty, dingy, dimly lit stores that rented adult movies. You know, and I was surprised after I saw a Blockbuster store.
So, I mean, I guess Blockbuster in your mind had the potential, kind of similar to Waste Management, a serial business with a lot of cash flow coming in all the time.
Well, Waste Management, we had to acquire a lot of businesses to get started.
Yeah.
But in Blockbuster, we did not. In Blockbuster, it was a matter of building stores before the competition did, because we had nothing proprietary. Mm-hmm. So it was just a matter of getting to the best real estate before the competition. And make a long story short, we opened regions around the United States. Each one was staffed on their own for real estate and construction. And over 6 years, we averaged opening a new Blockbuster store every 17 hours.
Wow.
So we opened a lot of stores in a short period of time.
Now, when you got involved in Blockbuster, this small company, this one store, that was already a public company?
Yeah, they went public to be in the oil services industry, and then that changed, mm-hmm. and they went into the video business kind of by mistake, but they went into the video business. And then when we bought the company, It had 8 company-owned stores and 11 franchise stores.
I see. So you developed that business for how many years?
We're a total of 7 years. And when we bought the company, it had a $32 million market cap.
Mm-hmm.
And 7 years later, we sold it for $8.5 billion.
It's unbelievable. You sold it to Viacom, right?
Sold it to Viacom. And the stock price over that 7 years went up 4,100%.
Incredible. Why do you think Viacom wanted that business so badly?
Well, they were trying to buy Paramount Motion Pictures at that time, and they needed to borrow a lot of money to do it, and they didn't have the cash flow to do it. We had a lot of cash flow at Blockbuster, so they paid us stock and then ended up with the cash flow that they needed to finance the acquisition of Paramount.
Did Paramount's anxiety or the need for their cash flow help get you the price that you were looking for?
Yeah, no question about it. You had a buyer on the other side that in order to make the transaction that he wanted to make Paramount, he needed something to make it happen, and we were that something.
All right, I'm talking to Wayne Huizenga. We've been talking about Blockbuster, how he got started, not really the visionary as everybody, as maybe the media has played it up to be, how he got started in Waste Management. Now, there's another company, Wayne, that you were involved in that you started very much from scratch, and I'm talking about AutoNation. You know, I looked it up, and AutoNation has an enterprise value now of $8 billion with revenues approaching $20 billion. How did you get that going? What was the concept there?
Well, after we sold Blockbuster in 1994, we looked around for a year, maybe a year and a half, trying to find the right business. And we'd hear about a company, but before we would look at the company, we would always look at the industry. And after we looked at different industries, we would pass on them. And then finally we came across the automobile industry. It was obviously right in front of our eyes, and we never really focused on the automobile industry. But if you think about it, it's a trillion-dollar industry. There's about $350 billion in new cars sold every year, $350 billion in used cars. Then you do the warranty work. Then you add in the parts and service, and you're up to a $1 trillion. Mm. And so the industry was so huge, we started figuring, boy, if we could get 5% of that industry, or if we could get 10% of the industry, we'd be a $100 billion company.
Let me see if I understand this, because the automobile industry is a very mature industry, but you're looking at something else besides the number of units being sold. You're looking to consolidate within it.
We were looking at consolidation, and actually, when we were looking at the business, we found some disturbing trends that we didn't like. And because we didn't like it, we thought there was an opportunity there. For example, most people don't realize that the average car dealer, 75% of the people who bought a car there this year will not go back to that same dealer.
Mm-hmm.
for a number of different reasons. Maybe they thought they paid too much. Maybe they didn't like the service. Mm-hmm. Maybe they decided to go a different way. But if you're a businessman and you lose 75% of your customers every year, that's pretty doggone tough.
Yeah.
And that's why today we see so much advertising in the automobile business, because they lose a lot of customers and they have to keep trying to gain new customers. And so we looked at that and said, wait a second, there has to be a better way. If you treat the customer with respect, if you listen to what the customer and your employees are saying, if you think about saying, hey, thank you for the order, it's pretty easy in business. And so we kind of said there's an opportunity here. We just treat the customer better. We ought to be able to retain more of the customers. And make a long story short, we took this concept public, raised a lot of money, then once again went out and acquired 375 different car franchises. And today AutoNation sells virtually every type of car. And we're in 17 states now, and we have 375 different franchises. And so all around the state. And so now, like you said, we do about $20 billion a year. And business is very good, and we try to treat the customer different than most people does. In some markets, we have one price sales where we quote one price and we don't negotiate, and it's a good deal for everybody. And we do that wherever we can, but in some markets we can, in some markets we can't. But still, we use the best practices concept, where we take the best practice from every dealership around the country. We use that, and we treat the dealer right. We treat the customer right.
Now, Wayne, the way AutoNation looks right now is not really the way it looked when you started. You guys made some initial mistakes at the beginning. Describe some of those.
We made some huge mistakes. See, you can't just go out and start a Ford dealership or a Chevrolet dealership. So we went out and we started building used car lots, and they were big used car lots.
I remember them.
20 acres at a crack, and we did that. But what would happen is we'd have a couple of thousand cars on the lot, and all of a sudden one morning you'd wake up and one of the manufacturers would say, okay, we're giving a $2,000 rebate on cars. Well, all of a sudden every car on our used car lot was worth a couple of thousand dollars less.
Mm-hmm.
And so that hurt us. We'd have a great quarter and we'd have a bad quarter. Then we'd have two good quarters, then we'd have two bad quarters. And so we said, okay, this is okay. But what we really need to do is get into the new car business as well. So then we changed our concept slightly, and we went into acquire new car dealerships along with used cars, and that's pretty much what we do now. Like I said, we have 375 dealerships.
Well, I know from the early days you were trying to brand the AutoNation name, but you weren't really able to do that. Why was that?
Well, we did want a brand, no question about it. We wanted AutoNation nationwide. But when we start selling new cars, the manufacturers said, "Oh no! You're not going to have the AutoNation name be bigger than the Ford name or the Chevrolet name or whatever the case may be. So you can call it AutoNation in one market, but in another market you have to use a different name." So all around the country now, in Las Vegas, for example, we're called Desert, and here in Fort Lauderdale, we're called Maroonie. And so in different markets, we're called different names, even though the parent company is still called AutoNation.
I'm talking with Wayne Huizinga. Wayne, of course, has been in this area for many, many years. He started out in this area, as he's just described. And he, again, as I said earlier in the program, he's the only person in history to build three Fortune 1000 companies practically from scratch. We've been talking about Waste Management, Blockbuster, AutoNation. And this is for our Entrepreneurial Spotlight segment. I know there's another business you got involved in with a chain of business hotels called Extended Stay. How did that start?
George Johnson is a very good friend of mine from Spartanburg, and he used to be a big Blockbuster franchisee, and he and I were friends. And after we sold Blockbuster, we were looking for something else to do. And one day George called me, and George was real big in real estate, mini warehouses and so forth. And so he called me one day and he said, "Listen, I was just talking to a friend of mine, and he told me about a new concept in Atlanta, and they're called Extended Stay Hotels." That wasn't the name of the company, but that was the it's like Waste Management. It's picking up Waste Management.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, "Okay, fine." And he said, "I'm going to go take a look at this hotel. Wayne, would you like to meet me?" So he flew from Spartanburg, and I flew from Fort Lauderdale. We met in Atlanta, looked at this hotel. It was the extended stay concept where the average traveler would stay about 3 weeks. It was a small room with a full kitchen, and so the people that stayed there could have breakfast or dinner there in their hotel, in their room if they wanted. They could cook if they wanted, or they could pop something in a microwave or whatever they wanted to do, but there was a full kitchen there, and we liked that concept, and so we bought that hotel.
Why did you like that concept?
We liked the concept because it was different than anything else was out there. They operated it pretty much as you would at home. Mm-hmm. They changed the sheets about every third day, and the room cost was down. There was no lobby. There was no restaurant. There was no ballroom. It was very simple. It was more like an apartment building than anything else, mm-hmm. with a bunch of one-bedroom apartments and a kitchen. And we looked at the projections, and we liked that a lot. They actually turned out to be better than we thought they would be. And in a very, very short period of time, we ended up with 475 hotels.
Did you take that public again?
We did take it public.
And it had a high multiple, and you used that to build?
We did have a high multiple, but there was nothing to acquire. Mm-hmm. So we used the high multiple to acquire cheap money on Wall Street,
uh-huh.
and we used that cash to build hotels.
I see.
And we did extremely well with that. And we sold that about a year and a half ago for $3.5 billion.
You know, Wayne, you seem to take your businesses to a certain level, and then you sell them. Why do you do that? Why don't you hold on to them and become, you know, watch them grow forever?
Well, the growth is in startups.
The real
growth is taking something small and making something big. But once it's big, you don't have much growth because the base is so large now. And it's more like running a business day to day, where we're more in the growth mode all the time,
yeah.
and that's the reason.
Well, I mean, also when the stock price gets so high, I mean, literally speaking, you have to grow like crazy, almost impossible amount, in order to get that stock price higher.
Yeah, and you know, we average at the hotel company, we average building a new hotel every week. Well, you think about
building a
new house every week.
Yeah.
Well, we were building a new hotel every week, and there was a period of time for 2 years where we averaged opening a new hotel every 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you're doing that, you know, there's a lot of moving parts, you know, and so finally you get it to where you got a good stock price and business is good, and you can't keep growing at that rate anymore.
Yeah.
So we then sell, take our money, and start a new business.
How do you determine what the right price is?
Well, when you get an offer that's beyond your expectations.
Well, that's number one, sure. That's the easy one.
Obviously, there's rules of thumb in a business. You get blank times cash flow or
right.
blank times EBITDA, you know, that type of thing.
Sure.
And when you get higher than the rule of thumb, then mm-hmm. it's time to sell.
It's time to sell. So that concludes my interview with Wayne Huizinga. I think you'll agree with me that Wayne was honest about the challenges he faced and mistakes he made, but was wise enough to learn from them and stay focused on his ultimate goals. He was also smart enough to understand that it was the people he surrounded himself with that made so much of the success possible. Well, that's today's show for you. Please stay with us a minute to hear another selection of the music of my daughter, Sophie. Enjoy. I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Malzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.